The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Welcome to Section D, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Now on this week's episode, we mull over the challenges and pitfalls of building pavilions. Temporary structures erected to stimulate experiences, celebrate form and materials, and hopefully generate a bit of a stir in the process. From London to New York and Pyeongchang, we hear from the architects and designers perfecting the form and using pavilions to celebrate public spaces and collaborate across fields. All that coming up right here on Section D. But first, we set out our stall on the continued popularity of pavilions. I caught up with the head of exhibitions at the Royal Institute of British Architects, Marie Back Mortensen, here in London, and started by asking her what designing a temporary one-off spectacle can offer architects emerging or established.
I think what's interesting is that practices, regardless of scale, whether you're a student, are interested in doing pavilions or pop-ups or working on a short-lived project. And I think one of the reasons is that it provides a tool for research. It gives the opportunity to develop something at a scale that they can't investigate in a drawing or rendering or in a scale model even. So it's taking research further and develop that and test those ideas to inform the practice, and then even if an installation is short-term, then that knowledge will live on and move into other projects. So I think it's that exploratory process is quite important for students and architects as well.
So in many ways, I'm thinking about it the wrong way. I'm thinking a busy architecture studio, should they be getting things on the books that are going to pay them well, that are going to secure an income for a few years? But actually, you think that it's this exploratory process which can be interesting. I think that pavilions actually, as an idea, they're obviously not new, but I think they've become more important in the age of social media, in the age of people snapping things on their phones and sharing images that are spectacular, that are interesting and that are interactive. Do you think that's also a pull for some architecture studios?
It's a good tool for promoting your practice. It's a good platform for younger emerging practices to get their name out there. But I think if you look historically, pavilions were very spectacular. They were quite fanciful follies with quite, you know, referencing historical styles. They had no purpose, they had no meaning. So if there was a social media campaign back then, they would probably attract just as much attention than they would now.
Is there a shift in architecture towards acknowledging, I suppose, that the built environment needn't be so permanent always, that we can use, I'm thinking of infill architecture, I'm thinking of monuments put up in city squares that are never meant to last. I mean, you only have to look at the London Eye or the Eiffel Tower to see these things often do. But do we think about our cities in a less permanent way now?
Yeah, I think so. It is a bit unfair to sort of overlay a meaning to architecture buildings that they should last forever, because they never do. They fall into decay, they're being demolished, they're being adapted and refurbished and upgraded all the time. But temporary structures have always been there as well. And I think you just put them into this sort of varying scale of the longevity, duration of buildings. And I think the difference is, for temporary structures, what you do is there's a different design process and a different construction process and a building process that is fit for that purpose. But I think there is a fascination with those temporary structures. And I think what for me is fascinating in terms of sort of the history is that pavilions and temporary structures were on private estates and parks and gardens. And now they've moved into the sort of the city and the public realm. And it's becoming more of a tool for community engagement as well. It's having a different purpose now and serving sort of different social needs alongside the more sort of spectacular ones like the Serpentine, where there's huge investment going into it as well.
And as head of exhibitions at the Royal Institute of British Architects, you sometimes have to wear a rather curatorial hat. You have to think about what is going to engage the public. What would you look for if you were commissioning one, or what kind of examples can you think of being temporary, but also of being thought-provoking and being interesting?
Well, every year we have an open call where we build one-to-one installations. And one of the criteria that we've embedded into the brief is that even though it's temporal, it needs to have a legacy and it needs to have a purpose. It doesn't need to be utilitarian, but it needs to be some thought put into the meaning of the structure and the legacy of it. So I think we get some really interesting examples of, if it is more of an aesthetic project in itself, then it is about a research around materiality and how that's informing practice. Or we had a very nice project last year, which is called the Befriending Project. Architects were working in partnership with British Red Cross, and they were working with refugees, so young asylum seekers coming into the countries without their parents. And British Red Cross facilitate dinners for them to make friends, and it was done in a very dull office environment. So these architects created a mobile kitchen structure that was used over the summer period at the RIBA on the terrace, where the young people came and cooked and had meals together. And that project is obviously it's a mobile structure, so it's continuing its life beyond that. I think those kind of projects for me when commissioning is very important. We recently did a very large-scale installation in Hull as part of UK City of Culture, and we commissioned the Chile-based architect Pedro Fernandez-Hausen and the Swiss artist Felice Verini to create a temporal structure, so six columns in front of Hull Minster. And again, even though it was a beautiful aesthetic experience in front of the Minster, it had a purpose. It had these cylinders and it had rooms that people could enter, and it transformed the space. So I think thinking about it rather, you know, in context and its purpose rather than as an aesthetic one-off spectacle is very important to me.
And you mentioned the idea that these might be kind of research-led ideas, but I'm also interested in these kind of interdisciplinary approaches that people take and collaborations. And I think there are probably good ways and bad ways that can happen. I suppose the bad way is that the money's always got to come from somewhere, so it may have a big brand's name on the side of it and some subtle allusion to you buying a BMW or whoever the sponsor may be. But do you also think that it's interesting and it's good to push the envelope a little bit and for industrial designers to work with architects, for artists to be involved, for it to basically create unlikely collaborations? Mm. And are there many examples of that from the ideas that you've received?
Well, definitely, I think always those boundaries are interesting to push. For our whole brief, what we did was we invited architects to choose their artists to work with. So rather than sort of force collaborative project, we wanted it to be architect-led because we are the Royal Institute of British Architects. But for them to work with a different practitioner to see how that would change the scope of the project and explore different meanings and different opportunities. So I think those are really interesting examples.
As a final question, and this is a bit of kind of blue sky gazing, so you don't have to indulge if you don't want to, but do you think we'll see more and more of these kind of projects as studios become more interdisciplinary, as companies are more keen to associate themselves with the ideals of design? I mean, you know, we see people, you know, companies as diffuse as Airbnb and companies that take oil out of the ground, all wanting a kind of piece or a say in the way that we make our cities, the way we think about architecture. Do you think it's now a good time for young architects to be spreading their message through temporary structures which are cheaper and which maybe give a bit more scope for imagination?
I definitely think they're not going to go away. They're going to be more of them. I think alongside all the qualities that they have in terms of research, experimentation, audience engagement, we shouldn't forget they're also a very good commercial tool, and they are used, you know, as placemaking in areas in terms of regeneration. So they do create attention and these pop-ups and popularity in the media. So we see more and more these structures being sold on. So they're a commodity suddenly, you know, they have a life afterwards. So I think they have so many different meanings now that they're probably not going to go away in the near future.
Marie Back-Mortensen there, Head of Exhibitions at the Royal Institute of British Architects. Now for a quick aside. Pavilions and temporary architectural feats can leave lasting impressions. Iconic structures from the Statue of Liberty to the Eiffel Tower and the London Eye were all conceived as temporary and sculptural structures that were so admired they stuck around. And it's in London that one such structure survives, in the name of a South London neighbourhood. The Crystal Palace was a cast iron and plate glass structure originally built in Hyde Park to house the Great Exhibition of 1851. Diversions within the Great Exhibition of Works of Industry of All Nations showcased a mix of spectacle, design and technology, which tempted more than 14,000 exhibitors from 25 nations, not to mention millions of visitors, including Charles's Dickens and Darwin, the poet Alfred Lord Tennyson, and writers Lewis Carroll and George Eliot. The vast structure captured the public imagination to such an extent that in 1854 it was moved rather than destroyed. It ended up in South London's Penge Common, where it stood until it was razed by a blaze in 1936. It's remembered as one of the greatest exhibitions ever hosted, and it survives the now vanished structure, as does the name Crystal Palace, now given to the surrounding residential area, football team and train station. Proof, if it were needed, that temporary structures can sometimes leave a lasting legacy. The Metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. You can drop Daphne Karnesis, our producer, a line. She's at dk@monocle.com. To New York now, and Brooklyn specifically, where the interdisciplinary practice Snarkitecture has made a name for itself for finding a sweet spot between art and architecture. Founded in 2008 by Alex Mastonen and Daniel Arsham, Snarkitecture works on pop-up projects, including installations for the likes of COS, Calvin Klein, the New Museum, and a pavilion for Design Miami, among many, many others. Some of the works are chronicled in a rather fetching new title by Fiden, which is out this April. Monocle's man in New York, Ed Stocker, visited the Snarkitecture studio to meet Alex Mastonen and find out just a little more.
Welcome to the studio. This is where Snarkitecture works.
Alex, in the preface to a new book out about Snarkitecture, it says that the practice, the studio, is neither architecture nor art. So what is it exactly?
When we started the practice between art and architecture, so my background being in architecture, Daniel's background being in art, and the idea was to create this sustained collaborative practice that would experiment and operate around the edges of these disciplines and explore the space between them. And the way that I think about it or would explain it is that the practice is architecturally driven. Staff is primarily architects. We tend to think in a more architectural way, but we have this artistic influence, this sort of license, if you will, that allows us to be a bit stranger and a bit less rational with certain things. I think the thing that Snarkitecture has focused on from the beginning that's contributed to our success is this idea of focusing on physical experience and tactile, direct, interactive, engaging architecture.
There seems to be an attraction, or at least an interest, in working on things that can often be temporary, or installations, or even pavilions. What draws you to that type of work?
There's really a value for us in continuing to operate in, let's say, a pavilion scale project, things that are, let's say, temporary, semi-permanent. There's incredible amount of flexibility and creative freedom there that we wouldn't have in, let's say, a tower or some other kind of larger building.
When you are working on something like a pavilion, what do you have to take into account that you might not have to take into account for, say, a bigger or more fixed project?
It's an interesting question. I'd say certainly budget and resources tend to be a little bit lower in a pavilion scenario. It depends on the circumstance or the brief, but I think pavilions are also designed often to have a lot of interaction and a lot of traffic in a way that they're designed to kind of attract people, like a beacon almost. And that's often how we're thinking of the more pavilion-based projects. Like Drift comes to mind, which is a project we did for Design Miami, which was kind of the first entrance pavilion project for the fair, actually.
That was in 2012, was it?
Exactly, 2012. And the idea for that was to make this pavilion entirely from the same material as the tent, so the white vinyl, turning it into this inflatable element that we made into cylinders that sort of spanned overhead to create a cavern-like enclosure. But we always thought of that not only as marking the location of the entrance as something that would be visible in a sort of strange and unexpected way from a distance, but once you were in it, that it would be something that would ask you to look up. The softness of the material would ask you to touch it or invite you to touch it. And we thought about it as a space for gathering, really, like a lounge. And I think that not every pavilion, but a lot of pavilions have that kind of lounge, or for a lack of, but just interaction and sort of collective gathering.
And do you think it also gives you, in a way, a license to perhaps be more experimental, more bold.
Yeah, certainly. There's opportunities that are available there that you just wouldn't have in a permanent build-out necessarily. It depends on the pavilion, depends on the type of project, but certainly I think for us, we find a lot more creative flexibility in these installation-based projects than you might in a more fixed kind of architectural brief. The freedom and sort of energy that comes from doing a shorter-term temporary project or doing a quicker, sort of smaller scale object, I think it's invaluable to let the staff sort of, you let sort of cut them loose and let people really exercise their creative abilities. And there's also challenges that are associated with doing some temporary projects, especially if the project schedules themselves are on a shorter timeline. So I think it helps keep the studio sharp, keeps ideas moving quickly, and it allows us to explore concepts in a way that, again, as we talked about a little bit earlier, you might not be able to at a larger scale or a more permanent scale.
Do you ever get a bit sad if something is temporary and it kind of ends up being taken down? Do you ever feel a slight pang in your heart?
Yeah, I think we love seeing the demand and the response that comes out of some of these temporary projects. Like when we have a project like the beach, whether it's up for 3 weeks or 8 weeks, to see lines every day, to see a line on the last day, to see people asking when it's coming to their location, that's really inspiring and that makes us feel really good. So the advantage of the temporary project is that in the ideal scenario, you sort of go out on top. But that said, there's certainly projects that we would love to see have longer lifespans or love to be able to bring to another audience. And it's something that we're working on in the studio. There's a couple exciting projects that we're planning now that are exploring ways to do that.
Can you share more information?
Not yet.
Perhaps we can talk about some of your projects. I want to highlight one in particular. I wanted to look at Playhouse at Exhibit Columbus. I want to talk about that because I want to know how this idea of a pavilion can also sort of translate or communicate a message as well at the same time.
Yeah, speaking of pavilions, certainly that's one that would come to mind. Even if the final result of that project was, it almost feels like an infill project, the way that it sat in the streetscape. So Playhouse was a temporary pavilion for Exhibit Columbus, the architecture biennial that's happening in Columbus, Indiana. And we were commissioned to do a project for Washington Street, which is the main street in downtown. And we came up with this idea of a playhouse, which was a structure really for children, but one that would also invite adults to engage with it as well. And we put it on Main Street between, I think, the oldest ice cream parlor in Indiana, the Children's Museum.
Which I've been to, it's amazing.
It's great, until the Calliope music comes on, and across the street from an indoor playground. So it's a sort of mecca of children, children's mecca in downtown Columbus, and right in the middle of it, we put this house that was designed for them. So it's a playhouse, obviously, for play and exploration, but it's inserted into the streetscape in a way where it's all 2 to 3 story buildings, and then all of a sudden you have this 8-foot-tall little white house stuck in an alley. But looking at that project, at least from a design standpoint, sitting in a field, sitting in an open environment, it becomes a freestanding pavilion, really. So that is, in some ways, how it was designed, was to also exist in an alternate site condition.
Maybe we can also talk about some of your future projects. I understand you've got something in the pipeline for Salone, and you also have been working on something. I snuck a quick listening on a meeting earlier at Coachella.
Sure. As always, there's a number of projects in the studio at any given time. It ranges, but I think at the moment there's something like 10 projects happening. We just opened Kith LA last week, so that's the latest in the Kith series in West Hollywood. Kind of a different space for us and Kith. So we've designed every store with them. So we've kind of had this partnership since the beginning, which has been a really interesting relationship. So we're really excited about the new store and Kith's first presence on the West Coast and really our second permanent project in LA. And we like working in LA and hope that we'll be back there. And speaking of LA, where, as you mentioned, we're doing a project around Coachella where we're building a pavilion. I think that's also sort of to be announced, but excited for people to see that as well. And then coming up really right after that, April, Salone del Mobile in Milan has always been very good to us in the sense it's good to every designer, I think, in that it's the biggest design gathering in the world and the environment there is really unmatched in terms of who's there and the level of work. And just the design community, I think, tends to be very supportive in a positive way. So we're doing really one big project, which is an installation with Caesarstone at a really amazing venue that I don't think very many people have seen. this kind of hidden gem within the heart of Milan. So we're excited to be able to activate that and invite citizens of Milan who maybe don't know about this space in their own city to come see it. And inside of this building, which has been abandoned for 20 years, will be our installation, which will be around, the brief for that project was around the idea of the kitchen island, but we've turned it into something, I think, a little bit different and a little bit unexpected around the changing state of water is the kind of core concept of that exhibition. At the same time, we are launching the book with Fiden. So that releases beginning of April. So we're really excited about having this first book of snarkitecture.
Tell me, how is it having someone like Fiden producing a book about you? And how does that come about in the first place?
Yeah, no, we're thrilled to be working with Fiden. I mean, I think for our first book, we couldn't have really hoped for better. The story is that when we first started thinking about making a book, the idea for the book was that it would be the first 5 years of snarkitecture. So let's make a book about the first 5 years of the practice. That was 5 years ago. So here we are, 2018. The book is about the first 10 years of the practice. So that's kind of how long it took.
Alex Mastonen there, partner at Brooklyn-based art and design studio Snarkitecture, speaking to Monocle's very own Ed Stocker. The first beautifully bound and wonderfully illustrated detailed study of Snarkitecture's work is published by Fiden and out in April. Last month, London-born architect Asif Khan opened the Super Black Pavilion to celebrate the Winter Olympics in South Korea. The structure, coated in Vantablack, one of the world's darkest substances, was commissioned by the carmaker Hyundai. The pavilion's exterior is illuminated by a field of stars that appear to float in midair. And we caught up with the architect behind it, Asif Khan, to find out a little more about conceiving and creating the installation. He started by explaining what makes Vantablack, the substance from which the pavilion is made, just so black.
It's the blackest material on Earth. Vanta is a kind of acronym for vertically aligned nanotube arrays. And that's like a carpet of carbon nanotubes, which are so precisely designed almost as a material. The tubes are the width of the wavelength of light. So light gets trapped in it as sound gets trapped in anechoic chambers. You know, the kind of wall has a texture that sound waves get absorbed into. I'm curious about the beginnings of the universe, about the world beyond this small piece of dust that we live on. And I guess the different scales of time that humanity has existed for. So I think compared to the rest of life on Earth and solar system beyond and so on. So I think this kind of, for me, there's the act of creating architecture is sort of, even though we talk about permanent buildings or temporary buildings, you realize that everything you do is within such a short time scale. Everything is immaterial, actually, and everything will disappear shortly if we look at the cosmic time scale. So at the other end of things, the experience of, you know, moments and memories are things that I want to create through the work we do, and maybe sometimes have more lasting effect than the great edifices. So a lot of the time playing with timelessness or time itself is important, and that guides the kind of experiences that I want people to have. It's a pavilion for the car company Hyundai, one of the big Korean vehicle manufacturers, and it's in the middle of Pyeongchang at the Winter Olympics. It's a building which of a typology that we've been involved in creating before. At Sochi Winter Olympics, we made a pavilion for a company called Megafon. At London Olympics, we made one for Coca-Cola. And these pavilions are opportunities to think about architecture from scratch, in a way. The pavilion is a chance to experiment or treat the building as a prototype. And particularly with the occasion of an event like the Olympics, people are in a certain mindset. So you're almost creating an exhibition of architecture for people who have the kind of nationalistic blood running through their veins from seeing their country members do the half pipe and win a medal or something. So it's kind of, you're trying to catch people's attention, but also let people dream a little and show what design can offer to the world of experience. take a piece of white paper and cut a rectangle out of it and put it on a piece of black paper, that's pretty much what this building looks like. It's like you've literally cut a hole in reality. It's a black rectangle on the horizon. Well, it's kind of amongst all of the Olympic signage, and the stadium is behind it and all that kind of stuff. So it's really like a moment of stillness that you're seeing in front of you, of absolute blackness. And it's the blackest thing, maybe the blackest thing you've ever seen. And you approach this, and this blackness begins to kind of envelope you. And you notice that the facade, I mean, this building is in plan, it's square, so it has a four rectangular facades. They're sort of pricked with tiny sources of light, LED lights, very bright, actually. And you get the feeling of a star field in front of you. And in fact, it's the real stars that you would see if you were looking at the night sky in that direction, exactly sort of measured in Pyeongchang. So walking left to right around it, you get the feeling of parallax. So I don't know if you've ever played on these early 8-bit computer games where you're going along a star field. That's the feeling you get as you walk around the building, like you're moving through outer space at extremely high speed. You enter this building and through this black star field, this cloud of blackness, and you're in a completely different space, a bright white space, enormous contrast. So you see it as though it's like the Batcave almost. And you look down and there's a surface, an enormous surface, actually of Corian, this kind of material that's marble-based, single surface material. And there are thousands, literally 25,000 water droplets bouncing around that surface as though they're kind of vehicles moving through a city grid. And because they're on a super hydrophobic coating, they're like water you've never seen before, because it's moving with extreme velocity and almost intelligence. And you interact with that surface and you create the droplets and you create a lake as part of a culmination of those droplets. You know, the sea is just a collection of droplets, and there's a similar idea here. And then you go through another small exhibition about hydrogen and you leave back into minus 20 degrees, hopefully having gone through a completely new experience of your visual frame of reference.
That was architect Asif Khan talking about his super black pavilion in Pyeongchang. Next week, we grapple with the changes and challenges involved in creating more and better homes.
When designing social housing particularly, I think you have to be really careful about how you manage communal space, who pays for it, and how is it shared, and how many people share that space.
Joe McCafferty, director at Levitt Bernstein, architect there. Section D was produced by Daphne Karnesis, researched by Pierre-Antoine Denis, and edited by the lovely Christy Evans. We'll leave you with Kelly Watch the Stars by Air. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.